And welcome to... Wait a second. Calvin, where are we?
Well, we're in the recording studio, but this isn't our podcast. I think this is another show on the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Oh man, we gotta get out of here.
Wait, maybe we should tell them about our show.
Hey, that's a swell idea.
Our show, Let's Pharmanize, is everything you'd want in a pharmacy podcast. History, pop culture, sex appeal, and humor.
We've covered the drug from Limitless, medicine of World War II, the ancient history of birth control, and more. Let's open the vault.
Crack that baby open.
Does one of the side effects of this medication include
a good time?
Because yeah, it's E. So there's G-M-A-D, and then there's E. E stands for allergies.
It's like this spider, like, drapey thing.
We have used wet meatloaf 5 times in this conversation, and that is 5 too many times to use the term wet meatloaf.
It's like a round lasagna.
I mean, you know, it hurts pretty bad, and you're thinking, man, unga bunga, this is pretty bad.
We post new episodes every Monday. Check out Let's Pharmanize on your favorite podcast platform and social media.
All that and more on Let's Pharmanize.
You're listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
Infectious disease. What better subject to be talking about in the midst of a pandemic? I'm a glass half full kind of person, so I feel that we're cresting the worst of what we've seen for the outbreak of COVID-19 throughout the world, and also the variant that has changed. However, I talk with lots of pharmacists every day and keep my nose plugged into many different news organizations and sources that pull information from the CDC and the World Health Organization. And there's concerns about the future of infectious disease and our immune systems not responding to vaccines as it should or be designed to do. And I thought that this was a great subject to dive into with someone who really has their finger on the pulse of this sector of healthcare and infectious disease. And that's Dr. Anthony Singor. He's our guest today. He's Senior Medical Director of PolyPip Limited. Welcome, Dr. Singor. How are you?
Great. Thank you very much.
So kick us off with my opening statement, which is this concern that our immune systems aren't reacting as they did 20, 30 years ago because of all of the advancements, the balance between the good and the negative when we are developing vaccines and many of the medications that have come out today, and seeing how the pharmaceutical manufacturers over the last 20, 10, 5 years, it's expanded by over 300% just in the products that are available today. So with that, what kind of concerns come from someone like you who really is in this this space every day?
Well, I think you have to break down viral infections separately from bacterial infections, and I guess to a larger degree, parasitic as well, because each group of pathogens has its own unique defense characteristics that it employs. Virus probably the least, because all it can really do is change its various receptors. And if it changes too much, particularly on the receptors that it requires to actually infect our cells, it can actually put itself out of business. So I think that strategy, as we've learned with COVID, has been very interesting, and fortuitously, the fact that several manufacturers have been able to come up with highly effective strategies built on the usual success, right? 10 years of work and another overnight success, but be able to deploy their technology very rapidly and effectively on behalf of humankind has been fantastic. For the bacterial side of it, there, I think it's the ability of the bacteria to rapidly adjust to the pressures it sees in the environment, both in the general environment as well as in the medical environment. But it's able to sort of defeat the drug specifically through a variety of mechanisms.
So drug-resistant pathogens of all types, antibiotic-resistant crisis that we could say that we're in from several news sources. One of them was nature.com that did an article on innovative tools that are taking aim at antibiotic resistant microbes. And they mentioned specifically tuberculosis. Can you use that as an example and kind of take us down the path of what the concern truly is?
I'm probably not the best expert on TB, to be honest with you. But if you step back a minute and sort of think about the mechanisms globally, how a bacteria, because that's what we'll focus on, can respond, it can either degrade the agent faster, it can exclude the agent at a pace from itself, push it back out into the environment prior to any inherent toxicity to the bacteria. It can change the ability of the target of the agent inside by its own mutational pattern, much like we talked about earlier with viruses. So there's sort of several large groups of responses that bacteria can do. And because they're, I guess, more concerned about the propagation of the species than the individual, and they can replicate quickly, you could see how over time, just by experimentation, these strategies can be very successful and, arguably have been for bacteria in at least the modern antibiotic era.
So what advancements are you seeing in diagnostics that can kind of determine how a agent is combating infection, combating what we're kind of after? Is there any, I always think of collecting data and being able to give a physician, give a medical team, even give a pharmacist that's specific to a treatment or a disease state, data ahead of time to see what may be coming down the pike of outcomes. And that's a curiosity for me, for someone that's been in, healthcare and serving and cancer follow-up, for example, with the experiences that you have.
So I think the advantage we have in the antibacterial space is that the largest percentage of response is really the efflux pumps mechanism. So you don't really need to know clinically, you don't really need to know which one of the pumps is in play, but you can sort of have globally an antibiotic that's altered that allows it to be less efficiently pumped out, or alternatively have a strategy where you can just overwhelm the pump mechanism by being able to get a higher environmental exposure to the antibiotic and then a higher internal exposure as a result of that. So I think that while it's interesting to know from a research perspective which one of the variety of pumps is being activated for a specific antibiotic, if you're taking a strategy of overwhelming the pump, then I don't know that the specifics matter. Alternatively, if you really want to interfere with the biochemical efficiency of that pump for a specific molecule, then yes, you would want a diagnostic pattern. I think that in the whole era of whole genome array and a variety of other rapid diagnostic tests, I think diagnostic companies will increase our portfolio for on-the-fly, hopefully point-of-service testing ultimately. But I think that's still a stretch goal clinically.
What advancements in treatment are you reading about or studying, or have you seen implemented in specific cancers that you have treatment exposure to, experience with?
So again, not being a medical oncologist, I think, as I look at it as a surgeon, where we've seen the biggest advance is the switching to more focused small molecules that are aimed at specific receptors that drive biochemical functionality. Very different concept than direct toxicity of the traditional anti-neoplastic agents. The beauty of that is it's specific to the tumor. We've been able to revolutionize, I think, a lot of therapy and now begin to think, because the toxicity is less, as a surgeon, it alters the whole concept of neoadjuvant therapy, right? Because you can now attack the tumor before it's been disrupted by any physical intervention, impact it with the newer agents aimed at its actual biochemical functionality, either whether it be a monoclonal antibody or some other small molecule strategy, shrink the tumor and make it more amenable to a resection approach.
How are you working with pharmacists in this space and caring for your patients after surgery and follow-up to ensure that infection is minimized as much as possible?
I think the whole concept of antibiotic stewardship was a nice concept to start with. I think it got a little clunky in terms of really rolling it out because it was hard to integrate the team. But now I think as folks have learned how to manage that process better, it's beyond simply restricting the use of an antibiotic or, you know, limiting the number of doses automatically in the EMR to a true collaborative approach of what are the best agents, both in terms of efficacy against the bacteria you're targeting, but also functionally in terms of delivery, cost structure, drug resistance risks. I think teams have become a lot more efficient on which antibiotics to use and how to use them within a process of care, not simply be punitive and restrictive in the approach to that process.
What about that colon cancer, for example? Is it a growing? Are we finding ways to grow the preemptive approach to that? Is someone in your space that's in surgery to see it, in real life, you're seeing it at its worst. Are you able to help to assess how the preemptive services that could be pulled through medication treatments or holistic habits, what kind of extraction of data can a surgeon give to be more preventative?
I would tell you from a public health policy perspective at this point in time for colorectal cancer, screening is really the best and most efficient at a population level. There are several different strategies. You can combine diagnostic tests with endoscopic evaluation, depending on individual risk factors for a given patient. But clearly, a regular utilization of a screening process, and you can really pick any one of the above. There's proponents of each, pure endoscopic, pure diagnostic testing for fecal occult blood or those kinds of strategies. But clearly using some regular and consistent approach to screening is the best way to avoid significant problems with colorectal cancer. You can catch them at the pre-malignant stage, with just neoplastic polyps, and at the worst case, an early stage lesion that's highly amenable to surgical resection. We should, in theory, find very few advanced diseases. Now, the risk is that the population has shifted for whatever reason to a population that typically wouldn't be engaged in the screening process, i.e. under 50 years old. So I think we need to learn as we go younger, even because the risk is lower, even though it's growing, the risk is still lower proportionally. You don't want a very expensive, invasive screening process. Maybe start at, pick an age, 40 or so, depending on the risk profile, with one of the biochemical strategies, and then scale up from there. But clearly, I think we will shift our process to earlier, much like we learned with breast cancer, and use it more consistently in those populations.
Dr. Senegor, I love technology. I'm a science fiction buff, so I always think of the real world and reality and using technology. Have you had any experience in using robotics in surgery, and what's to come as you've been paying attention to this sector of healthcare?
So I have. I arguably I'm a proponent still of straight laparoscopy. I think that's still a pretty significant advance over open surgery because it's minimally invasive. Robotics clearly has its proponents, and it has some advantages for the surgeon in terms of ergonomics and control of the instruments. how much that has really improved cost efficiency in particular can be argued. I think technically they're probably equivalent, straight laparoscopic versus robotics. If you think about it, we don't truly have robotic instruments yet. We have better ergonomically surgeon-controlled instrumentation. True robotics, I think if you're pushing the envelope like Star Trek, Star Wars, is autonomously functioning devices that either work in parallel with the surgeon or instead of the surgeon. We don't really have those kinds of tools yet. That will take a lot of computer power. And I think you have to think about image acquisition, layering that with normal anatomy, and then have the device be able to operate autonomously. I think that's a pretty sophisticated algorithm from data acquisition to actual intervention. But arguably, the instrumentation we have will not get worse, right? The technology will only improve, and any tool that can be more efficiently and consistently applied by a technician, not to minimize a surgeon's role, but even a highly skilled technician or a highly skilled professional will benefit from a device that can be controlled in a better fashion. I think if you step back and went with combat aviation, I think arguably some of the advanced avionics in the current generation of fighter planes would be pretty devastating to a World War II combat formation. So I think a pilot would definitely choose the modern avionics.
So tell us a little bit about your role at PolyPid and what they're doing in biopharma and focusing on the development of targeting, prolonged release therapeutics.
For PolyPid, the strategy of the company and its core technology is really the ability to control the local release of a variety of molecules. At this point, we really haven't found a category of molecules that can't be incorporated into the structure. And since we're audio, for the audience, I would make people reference an onion. So if you can put the therapeutics between the various layers of the onion, we can sequentially have the onion peel itself, and in that format, consistently deliver an amount of agent. For the purposes now of what we're studying, we're focusing on the delivery of doxycycline, broad, low resistance rate antibiotic that covers a variety of bacteria that we see clinically. And the focus of this is to be prophylaxis for surgical site infection.
Well, that's exciting. I think of the pharmacists that are going to be listening that are probably going to want to learn more. I'm going to have links into the show notes directing back to PolyPid. Is there anything else that you want to share specifically for those infectious disease focused pharmacists that are out there listening?
Well, I think it'd be interesting to know, since we'll focus on prophylaxis, which is our initial approach. I think there's a therapeutic option as well for the ability to treat high contamination surface type infections. But in terms of prophylaxis, I think clinically we underestimate all of the resources that go into the process from acquisition of the drug to actual effective delivery at the point of service for that prophylactic agent. We also, I think, underestimate the negative impact on the patient's microbiome and the environment at large in terms of alterations of the patient's microbiome and broader the entire microbiome in terms of resistance effect. And then that, in addition to that, some drugs, not all the ones we use for prophylaxis, have actual side effect and toxicity profiles for end organs, one being vancomycin, per se. So we have to think about if there's a way to get highly effective treatment at the site of contamination, which is what SSI is, before it becomes systemic, we can avoid all of the negative aspects of systemic delivery of a drug where we only really need it in one location.
I read a recent press release that PolyPid announced its 100th patient enrolled in SHIELD, which is a phase 3 clinical trial of D-PLEX for the prevention of post-abdominal surgery and in preventing the infection. So that in itself was an exciting announcement, and it gives you an opportunity to continue to collect more data, even through artificial intelligence. We just did a episode with IBM Watson's Health, which is collecting a tremendous amount of data from health centers, surgeons, pharmacists, to do more predictive setting of information for medical specialists and researchers. So that's an exciting announcement.
Yeah, I think the studies will be exciting because not only is it going to be the first real large phase 3 trial for our product specifically, but it's also going to give a broader context of the role of prophylaxis for surgical site infection, colectomy in the modern world. There's still some debate about what the optimal strategies are, preoperative luminal antibiotic, in addition to the parenteral at the time of surgery, the redosing schedules that can be problematic depending on which agent is chosen. So I think we'll learn a lot about some of the current standard of care logistic issues and where our product will play in the background.
Dr. Anthony Senegor, it's been delightful to talk with you. We hope to have you back and have a couple infectious disease specialist pharmacists on with us to track and to help and advise with each other on maybe even specific example cases, but really appreciate you being here.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the time. And this is an excellent platform, I think, to encourage discussions around broad topics.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Cheers.